Welcome to another episode of Double or Nothing. Michael, it's another beautiful day in Sydney. How are you going?
And I'm good. It's finally warming up, which is nice.
Well, I spent a little bit of time this morning, by a little bit, I mean like 15 minutes playing with DALL-E 2. I don't know if you've got access to, but it's an open AI thing where you can type in a prompt and it comes up with a pretty a uniquely generated image of what you're trying to do. And I'm trying to get a new picture for this podcast. And so I shared a couple of those with you, and it's kind of fun. It's kind of interesting what you can kind of do with just kind of entering written prompts and getting basically the entire universe of potential styles and images kind of at your fingertips. What are you seeing out there in AI land?
And it's amazing. I think this is the year. This is like the year where we take a huge step forward. I mean, even this, like when I did the original podcast, you would pay somebody online with one of those freelancing websites, just work together some artwork. Now you can just type in a prompt and again and again and again, and they're incredibly creative. But it's not just that, it's also music and like art and essay writing. So there's an AI where you can basically sign in online. Put in a few prompts, give a style. It might be jazz, it might be piano, it might be like dramatic movie music, and it will just create as many as you want different types of music, which sound really, really good. And again, these are things that people would have done before. And actually, the one that struck me most was like an essay writing one where somebody said, describe the limitations of AI. And then the AI wrote like four paragraphs of A plus writing, like crystal clear, summarized every sentence was perfect. And it was better than I think any, like, I'd hate to have to be put in a writing competition against one of these things because they're just going to do so much better. And this is new. Like there's no guarantee that AI would get this far at all, where you'd actually see stuff across music, art, and writing that would actually be seen as creative. So it's going to be profound. I mean, we're already finding use here. We should probably get some, let's get the AI to write some intro music for us, like a brief little snippet.
Why don't they just do the podcast for us? We can just say it's Australian finance investing news of the week. Just cut a bit of banter about it and see if they can just replicate the entire podcast and do a better job than we can.
Yeah, we laugh, but you could say like summarize the news and AI's and you could get a really, really good summary. Or apparently somebody used it for performance reviews. They just jotted a few notes on each person, then the AI just expanded it out into, as many paragraphs as they needed.
Because that's how it works. You typically just write like three words, like useless at X, did a good job at Y or whatever, and then you have to like wrap it all in this fluffy stuff, and AI can just automate that process of wrapping up the formalities around it.
Yeah, definitely. And it's hard to know. I mean, there's a few things. Obviously, on the arts, it's going to have a huge impact. And already you're seeing artists emerge. I don't even know. You probably just call them artists, but it's not even an existing format. So I saw one woman created like a new fashion video. So basically she got the AI to create all these different fashion things. Then she walked down the street, used other software to basically put the dresses that the AI imagined onto her. So all felt and flowed naturally and played music on it. Yet another one, she made a video where it was kind of like she's walking to us or the camera's moving around and there's like these screens. And as the camera moves behind a screen, it showed some the same backdrop, but like a super futuristic, adopted one. Or she goes behind another screen, the camera goes behind another screen, and it's all kind of dystopian and wild and like all moving. So it's not just still, it's like movie as well. And again, you're thinking, wow, imagine the time it would take to do special effects like that.
So why aren't we seeing more like visible commercialization of this? I guess we are kind of seeing it in like all the cinema stuff, but outside of that, like my wife, this is going to take you back. It's a personal story. When I first met my wife, she was doing a master's engineering at Deakin, basically for fun because she'd already done one at MIT or whatever. She had been working a project where. If you walk past a retail store, it will mirror you and kind of put the dress on you, and you kind of automatically kind of try it, and that's the advertisement. It basically projects whatever clothes or other accessories they're selling onto the prospective buyer. But if we kind of walk around the city, obviously you see nothing like that. You know, basically tech, like the most technologically advanced stuff are ads that are digital rather than kind of just posters. That's like as advanced as it's got. Why are we seeing such a lag, given how, you know, you're seeing these videos? I saw a video this week of, you know, some lady somewhere had invented this dude persona, and it was like a, it looked like photorealistic human character, like you or me basically, and she basically created a new voice, a new persona for him, and it was totally realistic. Why are we seeing this in like retail, in advertising, or anywhere else?
Look, I think there's a couple of things. I think it just happened. It's like you're in Bitcoin in 2010. Like it literally just, these things didn't exist. You know, like you could go, OpenAI has been plugging away at this for a while, but they've only just released it. I think all these things were released basically this year. So yeah, could you now, and it's going to create a ton of opportunities that we don't know. Could you now, for example, create a fashion label that's purely AI design? Like, and then ask designers to then actually just make the stuff, of which you could find anybody in the world, as in the opportunity to find somebody to actually make it would be a global opportunity. So find the most cost-effective way, but get the actual design, the creative input from the AI. And just even as I say that, it's crazy. It's like, so wait, we're getting, the idea was that like people would be creative and then would use computers to do the work. Like that was how it was supposed to be. That's how it's always been. Or it's certainly been the last few decades. But now it's like, well, the AI is going to be more creative and you can just cycle through. They can come up with infinite number of ideas, and you can just play around till you find something that really matches what you're looking for. And then, I don't know, that's just one idea. Just, you know, just get a fashion label where all the stuff is designed.
So I guess there are two ways you could look at it. One, you mentioned essays before, and, you know, kind of like writing about history or books or whatever occasionally.
Great essays, by the way. Everyone should check out Misha Sol's blog. Very, very good. Occasionally controversial, but very, very good.
Is it controversial? What's controversial about it?
I'd say the choice of topic is controversial, because sometimes you'll riff on views on, say, Hitler or, you know, the USSR. And again, like super interesting and fascinating to read. And I'm very glad you go into those areas. I, for example, would not write an essay. I've been going on what I thought.
No, that's fair enough. No, I've been going on a World War II binge lately, so that's a fair observation. But well, say take that, right? So I guess I could, you know, I guess the question is, will AI be able to do kind of you know, genuinely creative things and new creative theses, or whether in art or writing or whatever? Or will it only be able to kind of backfill, you know, what's already out there on the web? Now, like, I can't, you know, the second one we're almost naturally a little bit derisive of, but I reckon like 99% of value today is just taking what exists somewhere and putting it somewhere else, like cross-industry knowledge fertilization. You know, there's so much knowledge embedded in one industry you could take elsewhere. But, you know, can I... So I'm not being diminutive to option two, but with option one, you know, say I have a thesis that, you know, Stalin was the real, you know, or not the real bad guy, but say an equivalent or something to Hitler in terms of evil or whatever it says, which was not really the thesis of what I was writing about recently.
Wow, those poor people caught between the two of them.
Yeah, poor people caught between the two of them, or whatever, right? Say you have thesis X that you haven't read somewhere. I wonder how cogently it could kind of, you know, dig around for information on the web or whatever, and kind of come up with an articulate argument for you, right? Like I wonder, like I've no idea. Like, isn't that interesting, you know? Or I wonder.
That's
what,
yeah. That's almost like if you're going to make a point. Yeah.
Yeah.
Look, I think I guess I do quite well. Like just reading, just thinking about the things that I've seen already.
Well, let's talk about investing. Like, say I say, you know, I'm obviously, you know, by day, a software private equity investor, but we don't need to take that as an example. Say I want to look at retail investing, and I have certain criteria. These days, you kind of do a scan on CapIQ or FactSet or whatever platform you use, and, you know, you kind of see what's kind of trading cheaply, or, you know, has too much debt, or, you know, has insider buying or selling or whatever, right? There are like a gazillion scans you can do. But what if you can tell the AI engine, your thesis, the things you've invested in before that you've liked that have worked. And it basically kind of looks out into the world, collects whatever information, and goes, these opportunities are interesting for XYZ reasons. I mean, does that exist? Like, is
yeah, I mean,
that seems pretty
you could argue that
plausible.
Does exist, and it's actually, there's some interesting points there. So obviously some of the biggest funds are completely, you know, quantitative driven. So they do use this stuff.
Renaissance. And
Yeah, so Renaissance have been extremely successful. It looks like they're effectively, I'm guessing they're effectively market makers in the way they just print cash consistently. And there's a lot of funds, a lot of kind of prop shops like Optiva and a number of those that also consistently make money generally on market making. But interestingly, the machines have had a pretty hard time until this year. So bear markets, which we're in, tend to be really technical. They tend to trend for long times. Trend following systems do really well. But for most of the last decade, those strategies performed really poorly. So an example would be, okay, you could have a momentum strategy, but every time the market looked like it was about to crash, it rallied. You know, the crashes were really short. And also a lot of us that did really well over the last 10 years kind of adapted to that as well. You know, so we're kind of quite aggressive and quite quick on the trigger. You know, things sold off 20, 30%, we generally bought pretty fast. Taking the other side of the machines who would kind of say, oh, it's a trend, let's hit it. And then the wave of buying will just come in. But this has been like a long extended downturn, whereas most discretionary people are kind of upside long-term investors, which obviously has its place and generally performs well in most environments. But in these long extended bear markets, the machines are doing really well. But it's not just that. It's not just technical trend following or mean reversion strategies. It's also the fundamental quants. So, you know, these are ones we're systematically screening for, as you say, you know, cheap relative to earnings, cheap relative to certain balance sheet metrics. All that data is there. It's actually relative to art and movies and essay writing. It's I'm sure it's kind of trivial. But those strategies also did really badly because it was ultimately the best performers were kind of tech companies that were investing in growth and weren't coming up on those screens, even though.
I wonder how trivial it is, you know, like I think obviously
yeah,
doing like a scan.
As I said, I was like, I should not dismiss that as trivial.
Well, no, I take your point. Like anyone can come up with like, like a comp set, obviously at the most basic level, but then you can even do regressions and that stuff's like boring and kind of stock standard. But the best pieces of investing content, even when it's numerically driven, like you get great pieces out there on, TDM had a great essay about kind of relative software valuations like 6 months ago, whatever. Like people put out stuff that's pretty good. Like I wonder whether, will AI be putting out just like good stuff that's amalgamating information out there, or can they kind of, knowing your objective, effectively kind of find deep insights that you're kind of missing and kind of publish that kind of instead of just kind of giving information to assess, kind of get the answer, if you know what I mean, something you
yeah.
haven't seen, like it did with Go, you know? So obviously it you know, I don't play like the Korean or the Chinese game Go, and but obviously a few years back it kind of took the world by storm. It's this hyper complex game and it kind of crushed the best Go players out there and revealed totally new paths to winning. I imagine that's got to be happening already to some extent with the tools deployed in investing, but I would have thought it's just gonna, you know, kind of do that even more over time.
Yeah, I mean, on the actual trading side, I mean, I say trivial. I mean, there were people making money with quantitative strategies, you know, 30, 40 years ago. You know,
yeah.
I think Renaissance was, you know, many, many decades of operation. In terms of like kind of solving problems, it's hard. I mean, like the stuff that I've seen is very impressive and it's very nascent. You can imagine a lot of work, like, as you said, like putting together a comp table. Already there's pretty good automated stuff for that.
Yeah.
But add like a bit of an AI bent and I'm sure it'll do extremely well. You know, you've just got this little AI buddy there just beavering away for you. But I think, yeah, it's interesting. It's going to be the people that harness these tools that are going to do best. And I think it's one of those exciting moments that everyone's always looking for the next big thing. Like, was it crypto? Is it like, I don't know, some... At various times, different biotechnologies have kind of been the hot new thing. both of those things generally did kind of deliver pretty incredible outcomes. I think this is probably the one for this year that will mark a big change. And there's an open space for artists, for musicians, for authors, for business people to just use these tools, which you can now download, and a really new and really carve out a space for yourself as somebody who's got more experience than anybody else, because nobody has any experience in this stuff.
I think it's super interesting. You know, you say it's the hot new thing. I reckon AI has been, you know, on and off hot new thing for like 70 years or something. You know, last time we spoke about the disconnect between the kind of cadence of events versus kind of how we think about things. And so it's interesting that it's kind of been building up this moment for, you know, at least a decade over like my lifetime, and it's kind of got hot and cold at that time, but overall it's been kind of trending up and to the right, and it's kind of now kind of surfacing more and more. And to your point, I guess what you mean by it's a thing this year is that it will actually start to, you know, break things. And
I'm talking about these creative tools. That's the breakthrough this year. It's tough. I mean, it just shows like I like fads are just so bad to invest in. They always end up like Internet of Things and all those kinds of things end up going nowhere from an investing side. And funnily enough, I think this one will be tough to make money out of the people that developed it. So AI came out. You had to get on a waiting list. They had a monetization model. And then another one got released, Stable Diffusion, which is basically free that you can just download. So it's like, well, that really hurts their business case if somebody else has delivered like a very similar, basically similar product at the same time as you and for free. And I imagine there's just going to be a proliferation of these models. And then people are going to run the same prompts to the same models, all the different models, and then aggregate the answers from that. It was interesting. So we talk about creativity. So everything like you do is a function of what you experienced. You think about every stream of information you've had since you were born, everything that comes out is kind of like a function of that. Like it takes that in and spits it out. So when you're being creative, you probably are just bringing it different ideas. I mean, who really knows what's going on inside your brain? But I can see you're about to cut in. So I want to finish this. So what you can do is what one person did is they did their prompts, but then they used the computer just to pull random prompts out of the internet. So it's like you're seeding your artificial creativity with prompts that are randomly chosen to come up with ideas that are completely novel and new, and perhaps nobody has ever or would have ever combined those things together. So that's also a really interesting take on it. You know, it's like the next level.
Yeah, no. Look, it's super interesting. I think it's actually a deep and interesting philosophical question. You know, are you just a stream, like a process of every, you know, moment and every experience you've had since birth, or something else? And I think, I think the view probably I subscribe to is, you know, David Deutsch writes a lot about this in his books. He wrote The Fabric of Reality, and the other one that I've read. It escapes my mind, but basically, he kind of envisages the human mind as more of a universal computer, and actually, what we are doing is not just processing stuff; we're actually creating stuff, and we're the only thing in the known universe that can actually create stuff from nothing. And if you look at like the way, you know, I read The Language Instinct by Steven Pinker, and he also writes about how the words we're uttering now have never been said before. You know, language is not a question of regurgitation or just memory; it's an act of creation. And so there's like a nice little kind of religious overlay here in terms of the conception of the human as creative force and you know the role of kind of creation and the like as well. But just to kind of, that's a bit of a random kind of tangent, but just taking issue with the idea that people just kind of process every experience since birth, that's a controversial point. That's not obvious at all, which is just interesting.
But anyway, you know what, reading these essays, I reckon, you know, the Turing test, where it's like, can you tell if a computer is sentient or not? And that is, if you can just question it for 5-10 or indefinitely and you can't tell, then it kind of passes. Having seen the essays these things are writing, I wouldn't be surprised if these things pass the Turing test. And then who knows what's going on in the background?
I totally agree. I mean, half the time I speak to people, I don't believe they're humans as it is. So I'm on your side. Well, look, we've gone on a total like AI tangent, which is awesome. But why don't we talk about other things? So, back in kind of finance land, obviously Jackson Hole, Friday.
Yeah, I mean, that was brutal. I mean, there's been a few, it's become increasingly clear that the Fed is literally targeting equity price, asset prices, including equities.
Which is good for buyers.
It's good for buyers on a very long-term time frame, I guess. Price is going down. Basically, he had like a 45-minute slot. He spoke for 5 minutes. I've never heard anything. So he came up and said, I usually talk about this and that and macroeconomics and policy. This time I'm going to be extremely direct. You know, he's like, I've got, this is my message. It was just crystal clear to everybody in the market. Like, whoa. He's like, inflation is our number one priority. He said it would. And the words that he used that were extremely hawkish, you know, pain for households, but there'll be worse pain if we don't act. And then he kind of implied that, you know, the lessons of the past, to use his phrase, you know, make it very clear that you don't want to stop trying to solve inflation early. So he's going to go harder, even as the inflation deteriorates. So last month, inflation was basically, by some measures, was flat month on month. Obviously, the price increases happened earlier in the year, so the year-on-year number is big. It looks like this month might be flat or down as well. Everything's just weakening across the board. So PMIs are going down, energy's going down, which suggests there's a lot less demand. I'm talking about crude, not like European electricity prices, but even those have come off massively in the last few days. And so you've got an extremely hawkish Fed into like a really weak environment, aggressively raising rates while inflation is basically stalled. And that's kind of a really, really tough environment. So the NASDAQ dropped, 4.5%. Over the following hours and has dropped more since. And then Kashkari, one of the Fed officials, who's in the past has been seen as more dovish, came out and said he was happy with the way the market reacted, with the reaction to that. So they must have discussed, we want the market equities to go down to take the heat out. It's strange to see Fed officials so explicitly cheering on a falling market. And it's definitely a different game now. So we all have to adapt to the environment. Some of us were a lot faster to adapt than others. I was probably on the slower side. But basically, this is different to Bernanke. Bernanke studied the depression, and one of his conclusions was basically, it was the crash was one of the causes. So it was this huge crash that wiped out a ton of wealth that then echoed for years and years and years, and caused all kinds of troubles and affected spending habits for that entire generation. Which is one of the reasons why when the GFC came, he was so aggressive in stopping the crash. He didn't want a total financial collapse, even though at other times in history, and as it turns out, surprisingly, we're in one now, you have officials actively seeming to cheer on a crash. It's just so different to that. And, broadly, I'd say that was, the GFC was extremely controversial, but you had like a spectrum of countries that took different approaches. So the US is the most, the UK somewhat in the middle, but really did austerity movement. And then the EU was like austerity, an order of magnitude more, hyper-aggressive and particularly aggressive towards countries on the periphery, the South, Greece, Italy, Spain, extremely aggressive tightening through various means in those countries whilst they're in recession. So Greece had a worse outcome than the US in the Great Depression. It was worse than that in terms of output. I assume unemployment as well, but certainly in terms of output. So, Bernanke gets a lot of, the Fed gets a lot of heat for what they did. But from those examples, you can see the Fed recovered fastest. The UK did better than the EU, and the EU just had a horrific outcome. So I think history shows that actually was largely the right thing to do. You could argue again, even in COVID, that initial response was probably accurate. There was a total freeze up of everybody. Everybody just stopped spending whatever liquidity you had. If you'd put liquidity out, invested in something, you regretted it immediately. If you had cash, you held onto it. There was 2 weeks where nobody spent a dollar, but they didn't absolutely have to. And then there was this huge reaction from officials that then obviously righted things almost immediately. A year later, then they made huge mistakes, easing and then, in Australia, promising lower rates for 2 years into the future, which then affected the serious asset acquisition decisions of people to buy homes and things like that. And then now the same people to then tighten into an extraordinarily tough environment. I mean, it's extremely poorly played. You know, 2020, fine. You know, GFC, they actually did pretty well in the US, and the people that didn't act anywhere near as forcefully probably, you know, caused a lot of unnecessary misery that could have been avoided. But the last 2 years to ease right at the top and then to tighten now so aggressively is I don't think you would score those Fed officials particularly well on that.
So let me try and, you know, I always find it really difficult to speak about macro issues because I just feel like, you know, macro experts have really strong opinions on like inflation, interest rates and easing and tightening, whatever. And like, I feel like there are a lot of experts and they like all disagree. And so where I kind of sit is I just feel like I know nothing relatively speaking. So, but I guess I look back on the last 10 years and, you know, it's been basically relentless interest rates. So relentless easing, low interest rates, asset price inflation. Everyone kind of cheering along. Everyone's a hero, you know. Everyone's kind of portfolio is going up over the last decade. That's great. Now, you know, and people warning about inflation, etc. Now inflation is here, and so you know, and not all that's monetary. Obviously, there's just kind of like the supply chain issues, you know, COVID induced and otherwise induced in China,
money
and elsewhere,
squeeze, wars, and things like
wars,
that,
etc. So, kind of real resource ESG. Constrictions, ESG, and so, but I guess isn't this the symmetrical response where everyone was like, hang on, this is wild. The Fed's just like inflating asset prices. Isn't the symmetrical response where now it's deflating them?
I know what you're saying. I think it's hard to argue that they're necessarily doing the wrong thing now. I wouldn't say there's this idea that like asset prices going up, we've all got ingrained in our heads. Like if something's bad, it's good. You know, if medicine tastes bad, it's probably better for you. It's such a deep part of our psyche. It's a lot of religions are kind of like that. Like they're kind of like artificially deprive you of certain things, and then that feels good because you're doing bad things. It's like so built deep within us. But I think ultimately, you know, a 10-year bull market where asset prices rise from extremely low base after 10 years of going nowhere, where extraordinarily large number of businesses. You know, the tech space, most of these companies were founded and did all the amazing things they're doing, you know, in the last 10 years. Like, that's good. Like, so, and you got to be really careful because if you cause a crash that's too big, you can end up with serious recessions and depressions, which can then, like, you know, massively reduce the potential of an entire generation to push the human race forward. To give, like, a very concrete example, so biotech has very little to do with any of all this stuff. And it was like the first casualty. So, okay, we're going to raise rates. Okay, great. Now no biotech company can get funding, you know, and then no one can go to the capital markets. And so it's easy to be like, you know, there was too much punch. Everyone was going, but, you know, businesses were getting funded and people were developing drugs. And a lot of drugs are not going to come to market now because that funding market's been shut for a long time. And it's probably going to be shut, you know, at least for another 3 to 6 months. Based on this speech. And of course, you know, if they don't overdo it and it's not like an absolute catastrophe, you know, this time next year, you know, everything will be back and people, good ideas will be funded, bad ideas that didn't, or not necessarily bad ideas, things that just didn't work out will not get funded. And all those people have to move on to their next venture, which hopefully will be a big success. And then there'll be big successes in the next round. But I know what you're saying, like it's, you know, there was a big bull market, it's time for a big bear market. There's like this instinct that a lot of people have that, you know, tightening is good, high rates is good, equity prices down. It was crazy that people were valuing things based on their future potential. Why on earth would you do that? You know, it's actually not that crazy. And the fact that they're doing this has serious consequences in, for example, the development of drugs.
Yeah. No,
it's just a counter argument.
I think it's super interesting. No, I think you're right. There is this kind of Puritan urge to seek, you know, comeuppance, you know, for good times, you know, like this kind of self-flagellating kind of urge to kind of, you know, people saying, no, things can't just always be going up. There's got to be a comeuppance, you know, there's got the end of the part, you know, the music's got to stop. But actually, I guess, you know, in absolute ideal world, everything just goes up and to the right forever. Like if we start from the perspective that everything does go up and to the right forever, that's great. I guess, you know, so it doesn't necessarily need to be symmetrical. I guess, you know, I guess the question is, you know, with equity market, it's kind of hard to know. I mean, I'd say, you know, last year prices weren't reflecting, you know, you kind of, you know, snidely kind of mocking people, you know, for daring to suggest things be valued in the future potential. But it's probably fair to say a lot of assets last year weren't valuing future cash flows. They were like wildly overblown anything. You know, you'd have to assume negative rates forever or something to be discounting them for those net present values to kind of, you know, make sense. So I guess there was...
That is correct. I do agree with that.
Yeah, so it was a massive kind of valuation, like multiple bubble last year and maybe before. And then I guess a better example than equities is probably house prices. You know, like it's a bit of a it's a bit of a separate question, but it's obviously a massive part of the market, especially here in Australia. And whilst everyone loves feeling rich as their kind of asset prices increase, there is a downside there where, you know, obviously homes aren't just an investment like equities. They're consumable, and so you've got, you know, people being locked out of the housing market effectively, or certainly you know, property ownership. And so you know, whilst that, you know, that being cheaper might be a good thing, you know, it's obviously bad for owners. And so it's kind of, it's always this double-edged sword, which you know the Australian kind of public discourse is really schizophrenic about.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that one's a lot easier to see the upside of lower prices, isn't it? It does increase the access of people towards homes and freeze up spending power. But yeah, I was chatting to somebody in industrial property. It's like the industrial properties that were trading on like 3% yields. And now you've got 3%, like the 10-year in the US and the 2 years even higher, are both above 3%. And so a lot of these liquidity's apparently completely stopped in a lot of these markets, not many transactions. But prices have to come down. Like that yield has to go to 4 or 5%, which, you know, just mathematically is a significant decrease in price. So if that hasn't happened, to the extent that hasn't happened yet, as night follows day, if interest rates stay the way they are, and it actually looks like they're actually going higher rather than lower, then asset prices have to come down. And that's going to have huge consequences. And you can now see, right, you can now see like the biotech crash first, growth stocks crash first, then the broader market crashed. Maybe I guess like 9-10 months ago. And then now you're getting the ripple on effect finally in real estate. And then there's a good chance equity recovers kind of like in the GFC while real estate is still kind of down for a couple of years. You can really see like these things just happen in very slow motion, but you know, they're definitely happening.
Yeah, totally. So what else are you seeing? One thing that that caught my eye this week is, you know, Gonski or someone else is recommending like a cybersecurity panel or advisory board to the government, like the takeover panel. I think this is like not what getting this is like a super interesting thing, not so much a cybersecurity thing, but I think the takeover panel, just for listeners who don't know, it's basically this industry, it's not judicial, but it's kind of this administrative authority that's been vested with kind of semi-judicial powers, I guess. That's probably not the technical way to frame it, but it's kind of, you know, it decides on
semi-judicial, did you say?
Yeah. Well, in the sense that people kind of take over, you know, can complain and take an issue when there's a problem with takeovers in the Australian M&A market.
So you can appeal? Takeovers
panel, sorry?
Can you appeal?
Yeah, you can technically appeal it to the court, but I think I actually don't know the specifics. I think it's quite hard, and basically across the market, it's viewed, you know, you don't really want to cross the takeover panel, and the takeover panel can issue things like guidance to kind of help you navigate certain situations, and it's effectively got a lot of authority, and it's basically almost like a self-administrative thing, because I think, I don't remember, last time I looked a few years ago, it has like 70 rotating judges, right? Like decision makers or whatever they're called on this panel, like lawyers, and general like M&A practitioners. And so it's kind of self-regulating, but because it's rotating, you know, you've got a big pool and you don't get calcified, you know, kind of crusty old judges. You've kind of got live practitioners who can actually who understand takeovers, understand the commercial drivers, and can just make a business decision. And I think overall it's been hyper successful because it basically cuts through the courts. You don't need to explain kind of detailed commercial things to a crusty old judge who doesn't understand these things. It actually totally works. It's kind of self-government. It's a highly effective, pretty efficient, and it just works. People don't really want to cross takeovers panel. They don't want to kind of stuff things up. And it kind of made me think what other parts of the economy or issues like across society can effectively be relegated to a self-administrative body like this. I don't know if, I guess, martial courts, like martial law for military, might be an example. I'm not super across how they work, but that might be example. Or you know, if the medical board kind of decides on health things, I guess that's a thing. But it's interesting that cybersecurity, I don't know if that's a good idea or not in itself, but I do wonder if there's more of a role for these kind of extrajudicial bodies that effectively set the law.
You know, I think it comes down, I think the appeal of these things is they kind of have this veneer of impartiality and stepping away from politics. But I think the more serious the matter is, the closer you veer into politics. And then often politics is like a pretty good way of doing that. One thing I thought was interesting on that line of takeovers is where the Chinese bought the port of Darwin. Are you aware of this?
Yeah.
And so the US obviously has a huge base there. And they're just going to have to build a new port because they can't operate out of a port that's owned by the Chinese. I thought that was pretty amusing. I'd feel safer with politicians, weirdly, and it sounds weird to say, but I think like a court is much more obscure to a lot of people if it was deciding on like commercial matters potentially. Or does that make any sense? Like it's that split between like the law and politics.
What do you mean, sorry, by that?
What I mean is like if you had a court making political decisions.
Oh, I see.
Like what kind of businesses could or couldn't be bought, or how, you know, the Corporations Act should work.
Well, you know, the takeover panel kind of does do that. So, you know, obviously, Corporations Act is legislated by Parliament and they kind of create a bunch of laws, but it's pretty detailed some parts of it, you know, might either be unclear or might not go to a level of granularity that kind of is enough for every instance. And so the takeover panel will issue guidance, just like the ATO issues guidance and says, you know, with respect to this, this is how we will treat this. Okay. And that's not legally binding. You take it to court and the court will decide if that's actually pursuant to the legislation, but it really sucks to take the ATO or the takeovers panel to court. It's difficult. So they're not really creating the law, but they can kind of clarify and in some cases be the first port of kind of regulatory authority, which is tough. On the Chinese port thing, I always kind of like, I'm sympathetic to countries kind of regulating what foreign, especially hostile kind of countries can and can't do in their countries, but it's always like the part of this that no one really clicks onto. The conversation is always a little bit one way and a little bit confused, because actually it's the Chinese or the foreign investors who are taking the risk, nationalization risk, effectively. You know, just because they own a farm or they own a port doesn't mean they can suddenly build missiles there or like you know, do illegal activities. And in fact, if they piss off the local government, you know, the i.e. the Australian federal government or whoever here, you know, they're at risk of their land being appropriated and then being tried, basically. So they can kind of pump in whatever money they want, but they've kind of got their, especially when it comes to physical goods or whatever, like, you know, we're the ones who have sovereignty over that, you know, pot of land, and they're the ones that kind of need to be careful. Just because they own a port doesn't mean they can suddenly just, you know, have whatever
Yeah,
spies they want or whatever.
it does bring them
That's not
closer
how
to
it
it.
works.
I tell you what, I'd prefer to be a Chinese investor in an Australian port than an Australian investor in a Chinese port.
Yeah, look,
The
absolutely.
risk of appropriation is significantly higher.
No, yeah, that's right. And like, there's obviously power imbalance, but still, yeah, no, it's interesting. So what else are you seeing out there?
Look, this some really interesting like life sciences stuff. So we're looking at a company, Altimmune. Basically, we kind of it was one that we're looking at the lows, but they're one of those companies that just pivoted into doing like a nasal spray for COVID, and then obviously discontinued that. But their actual portfolio is quite interesting. So there's a new kind of relatively new class of drugs that basically allow for weight loss. So they're generally approved for diabetes. But they have been able to deliver 10 to 15% reduction in weight in people that take them. So there's one called semaglutide, owned by Novo Nordisk. And there's a BMY one as well. But this is a small company, and this has come out with some early data. It's just their compound could lead to weight loss of 20 to 25%. And it's been done in a small trial, but the data is pretty good. It's one of those open trials where it's like phase one. But it's pretty unambiguous. If everybody's blood lipids go down, if everybody's you know, fat in the liver goes down dramatically, there's clearly an effect being had, and it lines up with the data previously. And I thought that was kind of interesting. I mean, a drug for weight loss, it sounds like something that wouldn't exist, but it already does exist.
It sounds like something that absolutely would exist. Like, it
yeah,
feels like
it should exist.
Pills should stop that.
And
It doesn't already
it does.
exist.
This semaglutide has been around for a short period. It's just being ramped up now. But it's one of those ones where they're like really restrictive. It's hard to know how to get it approved. Like, it's not formally approved for what people will probably be using it for. And it's to be used in conjunction with diet and exercise and all that stuff. You know, you've got to run a fine, it's one of those things where it's a fine line where if you want to get a drug approved, you're better off getting it approved for diabetes rather than something more abstract like weight loss.
That's weird. Like, it's another one of those things, you know, you're talking about how when you're having really great times, you know, people have a moral need to kind of feel like the party's got to stop. You know, like, if I could take a pill and I could just become this beautiful, muscular, brilliant dude, or more
you already
beautiful,
are. You already
muscular,
are, Michelle.
brilliant than I am. Yeah, exactly. You know, why wouldn't I want to take that? You know, like, that makes total sense.
Yeah.
But people are deeply, deeply suspicious of that. But like, hand out fat pill, anti-fat pills, you know, as far as you can print them, you know, like,
Or like in
only a
Australia when
good
they just
thing.
took what did they take out? It used to be able to get those painkillers with a tiny bit of codeine. And then they just took them off the shelves because maybe one in a million people abuse it. It's like, well, the rest of us just have worse headaches now.
Yeah.
Just
Yeah.
trust us with a tiny little bit of codeine when we're really sick. But this is like, so there's bariatric surgeries, typically like kind of 20 to 30, more like 20-25% weight loss. If you can get a pill that competes with that, that is going to be a bit of a game changer. And I think the existing pills doing revenues of something like 160 mil a quarter, but it's still being ramped up. It's having production issues, and it's the market size is, what's that run rate? 600 plus mil a year. It's probably multiples of that, if not an order of magnitude higher. So I thought that was really interesting, which just shows there really are opportunities even now in times like this. It's so easy to get caught up in the macro, but there's a lot of like companies that are going to come out with some brilliant stuff. And
now's the best time to be investing. Like, you know, if you have a fund and you have capital to deploy, which we do, like, we're like, you know, we think it's a really exciting time to be investing. One of these episodes, I want to kind of pick your brain how to invest in biotech. Like, it's not really an area that I'm across, and I'd love to kind of hear how you're thinking about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's a tough one because I think it attracts a lot of speculative capital. And even at the best of times, it's extremely risky because these trials, you know, they often go forward with like a 50% chance or significantly less chance of success. And it's really unknowable, often unknowable But there are also ways that you can de-risk. And then there's just so many pitfalls in the space. For example, this one company we own, Bluebird Bio, that got originally invested in 5 years ago, roughly, and then ended up selling out, fortunately, because it got its drug approved and then was never able to sell it at a price that was commercial. So like most drugs that are approved don't recoup their investment cost over the life of the drug. So that's another pitfall. Like there's a lot of, and there's a different pitfall, which is crystal clear, mathematically crystal clear, is that a lot of different companies go for the same condition. And then all of those companies are valued on some percentage of success in that. So all the gene therapy ones, I mentioned this before, a lot of them go for the same conditions. If you've got 10 companies going for one condition and they're all priced on a 25 to 50% chance of success, there's going to be a huge amount of net value destruction because only one of them will win the market. Maybe there'll be space for a second and third if they can identify that they work better in a subset. But really the bulk of them, if you're the fourth or fifth person to come to market with a curative gene therapy, no matter how amazing and magical it is, you're not going to recoup the absolute fortune that's spent developing these really complicated treatments. So it's pretty strapped. At the same time, you know, the other thing, one thing I wish I did more of was allocate more to like the big pharmaceutical companies and the medical device companies. Because a lot of these companies, you know, they're putting 10 to 15% growth year after year after year, extremely defensive, absolutely nothing to do with the cycle. Like who cares what interest rates are doing? You know, the same number of people are going to go to hospital and need medical care. You know, it's a really useful place to be at the moment because the market prices is obviously as cyclical as anything. In general, they trade much better, extremely defensively, but the fundamentals, at least, you know, are not cyclical at all for some of these companies. Sure. So it is interesting in that regard, but maybe that's a topic for next one.
Yeah, I'll pick your brain on that another time. So look, this is our third episode now. I think like we're not really properly marketing it or whatever, but getting some good feedback so far. We should, and I haven't run this by you before the podcast, but something I've been thinking about, maybe we should reward early listeners or something. Like I feel like I get the occasional ping from someone and who's kind of enjoying it so far, and it's pretty early days, but we should think about something like that. I have no idea what it is, but if anyone has any ideas or has seen something cool elsewhere, they should feel free to send us a message.
Yeah, definitely. Feedback very welcome. I'm curious to know what ideas you have around rewarding early listeners.
we can issue a token and list it and make a mozza somehow. Like I'm just figuring out how to go from like
missed our moment.
Crypto gazillionaires. Yeah, exactly. Awesome. Should we wrap up there or
do you reckon... let's wrap up there and we'll go again next week.
That was fun. Speak next week.
Well, speak next week.